For decades, until his death, I kept wanting to interview John Schlesinger for all sorts of reasons. He made many of the films that I most admired. Billy Liar back in 63, which gave us Tom Courtney, and the extraordinary Julie Christie, who would be in his next film, Darling. There was Far From the Madding Crowd, Midnight Cowboy, Sunday, Bloody Sunday, a favourite of mine, Day of the Locust, and a wonderful little film that I often speak about on the programme, An Englishman Abroad, about the Australian actor Coral Brown bumping into Guy Burgess in Moscow, an absolute masterpiece. And I simply wanted to thank him for making so many lives all the happier. I also wanted to mention in Dispatches The Falcon and the Snowman. Now, whilst Gough Whitlam denied to his recent death that there was any CIA involvement in the coup against him, The Falcon and the Snowman says otherwise very, very convincingly. Now, I have another reason to thank John Schlesinger, and that is that he had in his attic a suitcase or a box full of letters, the most marvellous letters, and they've inspired his nephew and my guest to write a book called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. My guest is author, journalist, filmmaker, public intellectual Ian Bruma. Ian is the author of any number of books on any number of topics. He casts a very wide net: war, empire, fundamentalism, multiculturalism, politics, art, Japanese film, and some work he did with John Schlesinger. His books include that masterful Murder in Amsterdam, about the killing of the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, who was stabbed to death by a second-generation Moroccan Dutchman, and a collection of essays, Theatre of Cruelty, which spanned observations on everything and everyone from Anne Frank to David Bowie to Leni Riefenstahl, to this program's first long-term regular guest, Christopher Hitchens. Ian's writing is characterised by its refusal to sign up to any particular school of thought, to resist categories, and sometimes that confuses his critics, some who complain of him always wanting to see the other side. And he once wrote, "Thinking for oneself can be a lonely business." Ian's new book is a memoir of his maternal grandparents, Bernard and Winifred Schlesinger, two people whose lives a friend once described as straight out of an Agatha Christie novel, except they were German Jews living between the two world wars while being neither German or Jewish, or while being either German or Jewish, was dangerous territory to navigate. And it's marvellous that he could join us from New York. Ian, a warm welcome to our little wireless programme.
Thank you very much.
The book grew out of that stash of letters you discovered in John's possession, letters between the grandparents, love letters and other correspondence, which they'd sent to each other as far back as 1915.
Yes, that's which was close, not long after they met, I think. My grandfather was still at school, and my grandmother was studying the violin in London. And it was a family occasion, and she played the cello, the violin very well, and he played the cello very badly, to all accounts. But it's when they fell in love.
Wyn had burned her own dad's letters, hadn't she? She thought of correspondence as private.
She did. She thought it would be rude for other people to read personal letters, which is, in fact, a great pity, because they were, of course, my grandparents were not German Jews. They were very British, but their parents, apart from one great-grandmother, my great-grandmother, were from Germany, from Kassel and from Frankfurt. And it would have been very interesting to read the letters of an immigrant in the 1880s, but one understands why she did it.
Had you known much about their history when you discovered the letters?
I did know quite a lot because I was very close to them, and they only died in the 1980s, even though I end the book of the correspondence in the end of World War II in 1945. So a lot of the family stories were very well known to me. But of course, you get inside their heads reading their personal correspondence in a way that you normally never do, because they were very intimate letters. And so I got to know them much better, I think, than even I thought.
You have written about them before in that splendidly entitled Voltaire's Coconuts, because you described them coming to see you in the Netherlands as visitors from a wider, more glamorous world.
Yes. In fact, it was when I was writing that book that I first saw these letters. I knew that there was a family archive and in my uncle's in the barn in his country house in England. And there were photographs and documents and so on. And I found these letters. And I realized, especially reading the ones written in World War II, that there was a bigger story to be told. I didn't quite know how and I would do it, but I knew I would do it. And yes, when they came to visit us as children, it was like messengers from a more glamorous world. And I saw their lives, which were rather grand. One of my aunts was an actress, and then there was my uncle, the filmmaker, and they had a lovely house and so on and so forth. I thought that was England, and I saw it through their eyes. And they themselves, as typical of a certain kind of children of immigrants, rather idealized it themselves. So in some ways, I grew up seeing England through them.
Now, the book starts with the description of Christmas at your grandparents' house, and as I mentioned, it seems straight out of Agatha Christie, down to the name of the place where they lived, Woodlands, St. Mary. Listeners will recall Miss Marple lives in St. Mary Mead, so it's incredibly close to that.
Yes. Of course, they didn't grow up in a place like that. They grew up in Hampstead in North London, which is where most of the sort of upper middle class Jews, usually of German background, lived. So they were Londoners. But before the war, they rented a cottage in Berkshire. And St. Mary Woodlands, which is the house that I remember from my childhood, and it's kind of my childhood idyll, was bought after the war. So they spent a lot of their lives there. And it was a place more English than that is hard to imagine.
Ian, for your grandparents, England was the promised land, the place of security and success. What did they love about it?
Well, I think there were various things. One is that they were British in the way that their German Jewish ancestors were German, and that means more than the natives, as it were. And that is a fairly common phenomenon in a certain class of Jews. You find the same thing in France and in Hungary and so on, where assimilation means that you are more patriotic. You have to show it all the time that you belong and so on. So there was that aspect of it. And also, I think they felt that not only had Britain and Winston Churchill, whom they, of course, worshipped, saved their lives in World War II, but they also felt that they hadn't been rejected in the way that the German Jews had been rejected in their country. The patriotic German Jewish ex-World War I officer with his Iron Cross and was suddenly told in the 1930s that he doesn't belong. And that would have been a nightmare to my grandparents. And I think they, despite anti-Semitism, which was always there, social anti-Semitism and so on, I think they felt that they had been accepted in their native country, and they felt grateful in a way that somebody who takes their belonging less for granted or more for granted would not.
Ian, in Australian slang, in rhyming slang, the term 4x2, which describes a piece of timber, is code for Jew. In your family, 45. Now, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the little record. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with 1945. Why do you think 45 was the family's code for Jew?
I have absolutely no idea. it was family code. You know, people would say, "And is she 45? He looks 45, definitely 45," and that kind of thing. I don't think it was meant defensively as a kind of secret code in the way that our German Jewish ancestors, apparently in the late 19th century, when they were in public places and spoke about Jews, referred to them as Italians so as not to draw unwelcome attention to themselves. I don't think it was that. But the origin, I don't know. I do know that I got an email after my book came out from a totally unknown person to me from New Hampshire in the United States, who said her father in his 90s had been reading my book and suddenly burst out laughing. And he said his family used the same word, and he was an Italian.
Well, you've got a bestseller on your hands, so I guess you'll get other inputs. They did, of course, encounter anti-Semitism, the subtle forms that you were mentioning. And you recount how a retired colonel said of them when they moved into the village where they lived, "Don't like the name, don't like the money." But you also note that they were too proud to talk about that openly.
Yes, and also that particular colonel was treated as a bit of a joke. I don't think that they felt particularly hurt by that. I think that because they were relatively privileged, and a lot of the story, of course, has to do with class, they knew how to avoid anti-Semitism as much as possible. They knew what kind of people to dodge. They knew what sort of places they wouldn't want to be a member of, and so on and so forth. And I think that they were too proud to whine about it. But there was one instance when my grandfather was desperately looking for a job. He'd studied medicine, and he was a pediatrician, and he wanted a job at a London hospital. And in 1938, he was turned down by St. Thomas's, and hospitals were snobbish in those days, and some of them wouldn't have Jews, and supposedly because the patients might feel a little uncomfortable with people who are too foreign. That's the way they put it. And it galvanized my grandfather. Then wrote a letter to my grandmother and said, "It's the old story, 45. The job's not mine for any price." But it galvanized him to rescue 12 children from Berlin on the so-called Kindertransport. And he set up a fund called the St. Thomas's Fund to take care of them, and they took care of them for the rest of their lives.
I'm talking to Ian Baruma about his book, Their Promised Land, My Grandparents. My Grandparents in Love and War. As a couple living through the two world wars, their German origins could have made them as much of a target as being Jewish could. Winifred's family thought of changing the family name, didn't they, because it sounded emphatically German.
Yes, it was John, apparently, who wanted that. He was still a schoolboy, and he thought it didn't sound... So he had dreams of being an actor and so on, and it wouldn't sound right. But that idea never came to anything. But there was a difference, of course, between World War I and World War II. In World War I, the mood in Britain was much more anti-German than it was in World War II. World War II, of course, it was very anti-Nazi. But in World War I, it was the Huns, the Bosch, and so on, which did irritate my grandparents. In World War II, they were as ferociously anti-German as anybody else for very understandable reasons. But it was in World War I that my grandmother's brother changed the family name from Regensburg, which was her maiden name, to Rayburn, as though they were Scots. But it was because it was German, not Jewish. But I think in her mind, the two were kind of German and Jewish, they got mixed up because she didn't have any Jewish upbringing. She didn't know anything about religion.
After Kristallnacht, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but after Kristallnacht, quite a lot of Jews managed to get into the UK, and Churchill was very suspicious of them, and a whole boatload were rounded up, put on a ship called the Dunera, and sent to Australia, of all places, where most Australians cannot accept this, but it is a simple truth. They were put into our concentration camp for Jews in the middle of the Hay Plains. Let the record show it was a very congenial camp and everyone got on pretty well. But, you know, no matter how desperately Jews wanted to identify with the British, with the English, it wasn't that easy.
No, it wasn't. I think after Kristallnacht, it was almost impossible to get in at all as an adult. It was before Kristallnacht that adults could sometimes come as refugees, but they then ended up, as you say, in camps for enemy aliens and that kind of thing. After Kristallnacht, it was only the children who were allowed to come. So those 12 children rescued by my grandparents were part of that. And they could only come on condition that they leave their parents behind. So they would come as orphans. And it was Chamberlain who was then the prime minister. And also they had to be privately financed, so they wouldn't be a burden on the state. And thousands of children's lives were saved that way.
Well, that's one of the great things about them, the fact that they saved these kids.
Yes, and 12 of them, which is quite a lot, and kept up with them for the rest of their lives. And I still see several of them fairly regularly.
Ian, what's the quantum of the letters? How many did you sort through?
Well, all of them. I don't think they ever threw one away. I mean, there may be some missing, but it's hundreds and hundreds of letters. And especially in World War II, because my grandfather was in India then as an army doctor for 3 years, and without being able to go home at all. And often they would write each other every day, knowing that the letters would take at least a month to get to the other side. So you really do get a very intimate picture of them because they were sort of talking to one another, desperate to not to lose touch. So there are a lot of letters. World War I, there are far fewer, and they're typical letters of a sort of 19-year-old, stiff upper lip British soldier. My grandfather thought that his name, his German name, was preventing him from being sent to the front quickly enough, not knowing he was going to be in the Battle of the Somme as a stretcher bearer. So he saw the absolute worst that there was to be seen. But the letters don't reveal anything. The letters just say, it's a little uncomfortable here, rather a lot of rats. Thanks for the chocolate. Cheerio.
It must be odd for you, having known them as elderly, dignified people, to read letters between them when they were young and passionate lovers. Was there any unease or embarrassment?
No, I think it would have been much more difficult if they'd been my own parents. We don't really want to know the intimate details of our parents' lives, but grandparents are already a little bit further removed. And it's really the reason I don't feel guilty about publishing the letters, even though I know my grandmother in particular probably would have been horrified, is that it really is history now. The earliest letters are more than 100 years old. And it's far enough away that, no, it didn't embarrass me. I thought, in fact, it was very interesting to see the different ways that generations thought about sexual relations and that kind of thing, and the way the language changes. Of course, in the 20s, they used the sort of slang of young people in those days. So it was all ripping and topping and so on, and then gradually you see the language changing as they grew up.
I think we should point out to the listener that they didn't believe in God, yet weren't quite atheists. What were their convictions?
Well, I think that there was a difference between the two of them. My grandfather, his father was Orthodox, and so he at least knew what it was all about. He rejected it as an adult, but he grew up in a religious household. My grandmother had no religion at all and was rather opposed to any kind of organized religion. My grandfather was a typical sort of liberal in that he believed that spiritual life was important and that one had to believe in something, but it didn't really matter whether you were a Hindu or a Shintoist or a Buddhist or a Christian. He always claimed he liked Roman Catholics. He got on with them. He found them sort of humane. And I think it may be partly to do with the fact that they were also slightly on the outside in British society.
Yeah.
At the end of their lives, more often, they went to the so-called liberal Jewish synagogue, which is called Reformed in the United States. I don't know what it's called in Australia. So they didn't completely renounce it, but they were lapsed in many ways.
Now, Wynne envied those with faith, but she couldn't see any point or much point in taking kids to synagogue once or twice a year.
Yes, she thought that it would be hypocritical for her as a non-believer to try and instill some kind of belief in their children. And he told her not to worry about it. This was still in the 20s, when they didn't have any children, that these exchanges took place. And he said, I'm proud to be a Jew, and I'll stick to the traditions to some extent. Going to chapel never did him any harm, and so on. So he took a very sort of nonchalant view, really. She was a bit worried, but in the end, one of my aunts, and she's the only one who's still alive of my mother's generation, did convert to Christianity and then went the whole hog and became a Roman Catholic.
I'm talking to Ian Burema, author of The Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. And as I said earlier, Ian casts a very wide net in the themes and topics he writes about, not only in the books, but in his essays for the New York Review of Books, which I have shamelessly quarried for decades. And we're going to now to go back to someone else who cast a wide net, the aforementioned uncle, the great filmmaker. So I understand that from the outset they were slightly worried about John. Why was that?
They were very worried about him because he was a typically artistic child who really wasn't interested in anything except putting on plays with his family and applying makeup to my mother and using a film camera, which he'd been given by his grandmother and so on. And he was hopeless at all the things that...
Andy would play the female leads in the odd production.
He played the female leads and get dressed up in my grandmother's clothes and so on. And was hopeless at everything he was supposed to be good at, like rugger and cricket. And so he had a rather unhappy childhood, but at home at least he could indulge in his theatrical passion. But yes, they were very worried and thought he'd come to nothing and he wasn't, you know, doing his patriotic duty during the war and was always dreaming and so on. So what you get through the letters is very much a picture of the sort of the young artist. And a young artist who was also homosexual knew that from a very early age, even though I think...
I now suddenly see John's work through a different prism, and I take your point that the films are marked by a world of insiders who were outsiders too, up to and including Guy Burgess in Moscow.
That's absolutely true. Of course, it was written by Alan Bennett, but he was always drawn to dreamers and people who were sort of at an odd angle to society. Billy Lyre was such a figure.
Well, Billy Lyre, to me, embodies better than anyone else, any other character, the phenomenon, or the growing phenomenon of the 1960s.
Yes. But also the boy stuck in a provincial town dreaming of... heroic roles and that kind of thing, and not being able to quite make it when Julie Christie wants him to come with her to London. But he had enormous sympathy for these people that some might call losers. He didn't see them as such. He had great empathy for them because when he grew up, especially at boarding school, he felt like a loser, and he was lost in his dreams that, of course, later went into his art.
And I'm suddenly remembering, I suppose, the film which most beautifully characterises this sense of being outside, and that would be Midnight Cowboy. He worked very successfully across the Atlantic, didn't he?
Well, not entirely. He did some of his best work in America, but I think he couldn't stand not working. And so he would sometimes take on projects that perhaps he would have been better off leaving alone. So I think he made some films in America that perhaps he later wished he hadn't. I think actually his very best work was done in England because he understood it so well.
Yeah.
And Sunday Bloody Sunday, I think, is his great just masterpiece. But as you yourself mentioned, An Englishman Abroad is also wonderful, and so is Billy Lyre in A Kind of Loving. So it was difficult for his generation, I think, because it wasn't very easy to make films in Britain. And
to say the
temptations
least, yeah.
To come to America.
No, well, he was an heroic filmmaker, let the record show. Now, back to the letters. They write to each other in the lead up to World War II, and during it there's little mention of the growing horror in Germany. They must have had relatives there. Why do you think they avoided mentioning Hitler and the escalation?
Well, it's there, but it's not spelled out. I mean, they were members of the League Against Anti-Semitism and would go to conferences and that kind of thing. She did visit her family in 1932. There is mention of going to Kassel, and she doesn't mention it then. And of course, Hitler wasn't yet in power, but things were already getting pretty nasty. And I think it's because the Jews of their class in Germany also pretended it wasn't happening for a long time and sort of thought it would blow over. And after all, Germany was a civilized country. How could a Bulgarian like Hitler possibly last and that kind of thing? But in the mid-30s, there are mentions of it because a relative of my grandmother's, who was then still a teenager, came to England to escape from the Nazis and became a very, very much an English gentleman in time. So I think they were aware of it. But it's, of course, it's difficult to... We know so much more now, and it's hard to know exactly how people in the mid-30s were thinking. I mean, I think probably a lot of people thought this can't last, it'll blow over.
Ian, last night on the program we were discussing the life and death of Polish Jews and an alleged renaissance of Jewish culture in Poland. I remain to be convinced, but there's a very large Polish Jewish community in Melbourne and an exhibition regarding Poland, and it emerged in that discussion that many, many Holocaust survivors in Melbourne, and I know everywhere else, were so damned reluctant to talk about their experiences after the war, they kept them bottled up for decades.
Yes. Well, I think it's understandable because having been singled out for special treatment, as it were, once in such a horrific manner, a lot of people really didn't want to be singled out again and just wanted to live out their lives and in peace. And it's a very common thing that survivors of these catastrophes keep their heads down, and it's their children and grandchildren who then really start sort of digging up the past.
I love some of the little anecdotes. Here's John, her oldest son, soon too old to be called up. But you didn't like the sound of that. But you point out that John did manage to spend much of the war fighting bravely in the Army's entertainment division, putting on drag shows for the troops.
In Singapore, yes. And that was later made into a musical, Privates on Parade.
Directed by an old friend of mine, Michael Blakemore.
That's right. I think they had a great time with some... what's his name, the comedian, Williams. I can't remember his first name now. But they had a wonderful time. But he was terrified at the end of the war that he'd be called up, and so was his mother, because he was completely unsuited to be a soldier. The first thing he did was lose his rifle, apparently. Then ended up in hospital being very ill. So he was terrified of being sent off to the Far East to have to fight the Japanese. But thank goodness the war was over before that was necessary, and he went to Singapore and entertained the troops instead.
Heavens above, we're running out of time and we're just warming up, but I want to do a detour and ask you about a piece which got you into very hot water and which still divides critics years later, and that was a review of some books and plays about Anne Frank. And you said that her book had been distorted and sentimentalised into an argument about Jewish identity. What led to that conclusion, Ian, and why did it provoke such hate mail?
The controversy about Anne Frank's diary, in fact, it has direct bearing on the book about my grandparents, because it was really about class. It was about sort of upper-middle-class German Jews, the family that Anne Frank herself came from and her father represented, and Jews from Poland and Lithuania and so on who were more religious, more traditional, And in America, as in Europe, there is that still causes tensions. And the accusation was by some people that Otto Frank, Anne's father, had sort of taken the Jewishness deliberately out of the diary to universalize the message. And there was some truth to that. But it was also true that they were quite assimilated. And many people felt that she should be the sort of symbol of Jewish suffering, not of universal racism and that kind of thing, which was rather what Otto wanted. And so I wrote a piece about that divide and expressed a certain sympathy for Otto, which did not make me popular in certain circles.
Well, Ian, I think this book will make you very popular, and I commend you for
your... Well, that's very kind of you to say.
I commend you for your efforts, and thanks for coming on. Ian Buruma, author most recently of the memoir Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. Thank you, Ian. LNL on RN.